How's it going, y'all? Kevin Kuhn here from Athlete Factors. This is the Athlete Factors podcast, and I'm here with my favorite teacher and professor of all time, Dr. Darren Willoughby. How you doing, Doc?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well. Thank you so much for giving me the time. I've actually mentioned you a couple times on some other podcasts just because when it comes to the amount that I've learned, undergrad, grad school, after grad school, the three classes I had with you account for, I don't know, probably 90% of what I think I know about exercise physiology and nutritional biochemistry. So you've had a huge influence on not only my academic career, but my ability to apply that to you know, the in the trenches training and really just the application of that knowledge. So just wanted to start out with that. Thank you so much for having an impact in my life. I really, you know, I really appreciate it.
Well, I thank you very much. I appreciate those kind words. And, you know, conversely, I appreciated you as a student, your commitment, your dedication and your diligence, your resilience to learn as much as possible. And now that you've been able to get yourself in a position to start applying that information, you know, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. You know, I can sit and talk in the classroom till I'm blue in the face about research or whatever the case may be, or more on a practical note with training athletes and non-athletes alike. And so, you know, if the information that we talk about in class is not practical and applicable, then, you know, what good is it really? So I'm glad to know that you found it useful. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, extremely useful. I mean, the amount of practical nutrition info that we would get in neuromuscular exercise physiology class and cardiopulmonary exercise physiology class, like, was way more than I learned from my nutrition classes. So
and they weren't even nutrition classes that you took for me to take phys.
Yeah.
The exercise biochem, obviously, that was more nutritional biochemistry, exercise biochemistry, kind of all wrapped up into one. But still, you know, you can't, you know, regardless whether it's, you know, you're talking about neuromuscular exercise phys or cardiopulmonary exercise physiology, you know, you point blank, you can't exercise without energy, and you don't have energy without nutrition. So, you know, it all dovetails into each other quite nicely. So sometimes that's overlooked, but, you know, again, it kind of goes hand in hand.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest issues with, the quote unquote practitioner of exercise physiology or kinesiology or whatever the case may be is they tend to get pigeonholed into just the training or just the nutrition. And as much as possible, I try not to, you know, get backed into either one of those corners, just because you have to have a solid foundation of both if you want to be able to get the most out of your athletes and provide the most benefit for them. So, that's why I love your classes. We got both.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, nutrition and training, they're not mutually exclusive, but they're actually mutually inclusive. They have to be. Mm-hmm. So, because one doesn't occur without the other and vice versa.
For sure.
At least on an optimum level or suboptimum level in athletes, you know, or non-athletes, but high performance training individuals. So.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, I'm always looking for not just what works, but what works optimally. And so I try as much as possible to stay on top of things. And one way I do that is to bring on guests who know what they're talking about. So
I don't know that I know what I'm talking about, but maybe sometimes it sounds like I do.
Awesome. Well, would you give us a little bit of background about yourself? Kind of where you're from, what you studied in college and grad school, and kind of what you've done work-wise up until now?
Sure. I'll try to keep it short, sweet, and wrapped up in a nutshell. So, you know, you know better than I, as well as I do. Sometimes that's difficult for me. So, I mean, I've been an athlete all my life. It still am, you know, to some extent, and would be if it wasn't for a bad knee that I just recent about a year ago had finally totally replaced. But I played sports all through as a kid up through junior high school. I mean, and high school, you know, was a multi-sport letterman, but excelled mainly in football and baseball, and then went to college on playing football. And so as an undergrad, my undergraduate degree was kinesiology, if you will. And way back then, I wanted to be, when I finished, graduated, I wanted to be a high school football coach and teach science, biology and chemistry, because I really, really enjoyed the sciences. Hated math, wasn't good in math, but I really did well, and I really enjoyed the sciences, you know, particularly biological science. And so, and then my junior year, I had to take anatomy and physiology, and so that opened the door for me, particularly the physiology portion of the class, just getting an understanding how our body works. And because up to that point, I really didn't know. I mean, I loved to work out, and I knew if I worked out and I really worked out hard, my body would adapt and respond. But so I finally got into a point where I started to begin to realize a bit why. And then I started getting even more interested in kind of exercise physiology. And of course, way back then, exercise physiology was still a fairly new discipline or subdiscipline, I guess, if you will, within physical education, kinesiology. And and then when I finished my bachelor's degree, I worked as a fitness director in Dallas and in Fort Worth. I'm from a very small town in Texas called Eastland. And so I went to Tarleton State University in Stephenville, Texas for my bachelor's. And as I said, then I was working as a fitness director, and I did that for about a year and a half. And then I decided I wanted to go back and work on my master's. So I went back to Tarleton. And Tarleton's program was good, but it was more general. You know, it wasn't a heavy science program. Mm-hmm. I finished there, did well, and just was even more fascinated about exercise physiology and nutrition, because, you know, at that point I'd quit playing football in college, but I enjoyed lifting weights. And so I continued on lifting weights and started doing competitive powerlifting, but bodybuilding more. And I enjoyed bodybuilding more because of the nutritional piece. I like being able to use training and nutrition as a way to kind of sculpt my physique. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of my buddies, they like to do powerlifting because they could just, you know, they go and lift and all they cared about was getting as strong as possible, and they'd eat what they wanted. You know, they mm-hmm. didn't care how they looked. And so, you know, and so of course I did, but I wouldn't say not totally from a vanity perspective, but more so from trying to use the information I had learned or I knew up to that point nutritionally and training wise to make a difference in my physique. And so, mm-hmm. I did that for, and then after I finished my master's degree, then I was, even more interested. And so I went to Texas A&M for my PhD. And so I got my PhD in exercise physiology, but I specialized in muscle physiology and biochemistry. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of subspecialized in nutritional biochemistry and molecular physiology. Because at that point, I was really, 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 really interested in exactly understanding how the body worked in regards to exercise, not so much on the macro level, but now more so on the micro level, and even at the biochemical and molecular level. So, you know, what causes genes to be turned on to make new proteins, and how do those new proteins incorporate themselves in the cell matrix and in muscle and actually start doing their jobs and being able to increase muscle contractile force and then increase size with training and so on and so forth, or muscle power, whatever the primary adaptational stimulus is. And so anyway, and so and then after that, I took a visiting assistant professor appointment at University of Houston in Clear Lake for a year. And then from there, I got to academia for about almost 3 years. And I worked as a director for cardiopulmonary rehab right outside of Fort Worth. And I started missing academia, and I went back into academia. as assistant professor at the University of Southern Maine in Portland, Maine. I was there for 4 years and started and created and directed a new exercise physiology lab there. And then I came back to Texas and then was on faculty at TCU, Texas Christian University. And I was there for 5 years and was tenured and promoted and then was recruited to come to Baylor back in 2004. So I've been here 15 years, kind of hard to believe I've been here that long. And so, you know, over the course of time with that, you know, honing my research and my analytical skills in the biochemistry lab, I've still continued to be very passionate and interested in the practical piece of training and conditioning, strength and conditioning. So, you know, when I was at Texas A&M, I volunteered and worked in the weight room with strength and conditioning coaches, working with athletes. Mm-hmm. When I was at the University of Southern Maine, I did the same thing. And then when I was at TCU, I did the same thing. And then since being here at Baylor, I've done that off and on as best I can. Mm-hmm. So this past semester and even now, I've been hired on staff for Baylor football, where I've been working with them more on a nutritional consultant for some of the players that we have that we really need to put weight on them or take weight off. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've enjoyed that a great deal. And so I've tried to stay as close to the practical aspect as possible and try to be as best as possible a liaison between the basic science and the practical science. And so understanding the basic science as well as I do, understanding the practical applied science as well as I do, then I feel well suited that I can actually bridge that gap and actually, you know, I can be a lab scientist, but just as easily I could change careers and be a strength and conditioning coach as well. Mm-hmm. So that helps me be able to, you know, use what I've learned and my knowledge from the lab and my research to better funnel that into what I teach you guys in the classroom. Or what I taught you guys and what I teach in the classroom that you can actually use and apply to your clients on a practical level. Because like I said earlier, if you can't, you know, you can take all that information, but if it ends up not being practical and applied, then again, what good is it? You know, it needs to be translational. We need to be able to make it work and make an impact and a difference in somebody's life. So anyway, so there you go.
Awesome. Sweet. Well, That's kind of a perfect segue into a couple of things I wanted to cover. So I guess first and foremost, I'm seeing a ton of stuff on like Instagram and Facebook now about how, you know, like it's this false dichotomy where calories don't matter. It's all about hormones, right? So it's like you got to pick one or the other. And it's funny because I wrote a book back in 2013 about how you can affect your metabolism by addressing or by eating specific foods at specific times, training specific ways to take advantage of your hormones. But then earlier this year, I wrote a book about how important it is to view calories like currency for your body, and you have to set up a budget. You have to know how much you need in order for long-term, maintainable, sustainable changes to be made. So, can you talk a little bit about I guess that dichotomy? Are calories dead? And and what's the importance of knowing your caloric need for an athlete?
Yeah, that's actually kind of a good lead-in question, and it opens several doors. One is that calories absolutely matter. Hypocalorism doesn't allow us to do much of anything performance-wise, particularly optimum performance in the scope of adaptation over time with training. The other thing is that nutrition, and let's say whether we're consistently hypercaloric or hypocaloric, will impact various hormones as well. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, if somebody stays hypocaloric, significantly hypocaloric on a very low calorie diet, that generates a stress response. And so those individuals are going to find themselves dealing with elevated levels of cortisol, for instance. Mm-hmm. Of course, we know that obviously carbohydrate intake impacts insulin levels. We know that the lack thereof impacts glucagon levels. We also know that, you know, a stress response ongoing just generates increases in catecholamine responses, adrenaline, you know, particularly that that will help in fuel mobilization, which, and that's the other thing, a lot of these hormones that we talked about, that's their role is for substrate mobilization. Mm-hmm. So obviously insulin, we have substrate mobilization from the standpoint of helping to move or facilitating the process of carbohydrate uptake into muscle, particularly, and then of course, adipose tissue as well, if we're taking in too much of it. Glucagon facilitates, you know, obviously liver glycogen breakdown, liver glycogenolysis, but also gluconeogenesis as well, if we're utilizing protein for a fuel source, which we don't, hopefully we don't, we're not doing. And then you've got issues of, like I said, epinephrine stimulates glycogen breakdown not only in the liver, but in skeletal muscle as well. And in adipose, fat tissue, it stimulates upregulation of hormone sensitive lipase or the process of lipolysis, where we're actually unesterifying triglycerides so that the body can use those fatty acids for fuel. So, you know, I use that in a roundabout way to say that that calories make a huge difference and calories impact hormones. And, you know, the lack of calories impact hormones, the abundance of calories impact hormones as well. And so, again, it's one of these things where you can't really have one without the other. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are a number of hormones that are metabolic, non or pseudo metabolic or metabolic, that may or may not be affected as significantly, you know, that you can have the, you know, orexigenic or anorexigenic hormones, leptin, ghrelin, obviously help drive either the sensation to feed or the sensation not to feed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those are impacted by other hormones as well. So, you know, it's kind of like a Pandora's box, if you will, or it's kind of like a grab bag, so to speak, from the standpoint of some of them work collectively together, some of them don't. But again, they're all impacted by calories in one way or another, either too much or just enough or not enough. So
gotcha. So that's, I guess, the trigger or the issue that I see related to that, these posts online where people talk about not being able to lose weight while being in a calorie deficit. And so that's why they don't believe in calories anymore, or being unable to gain weight while they're in a calorie surplus. And that's why they don't think calories work anymore. And I'm just like, well, obviously the way you're measuring whether you're in a calorie surplus or calorie deficit is not accurate, or you're not giving it enough time, or maybe you're expending more calories than you think you are, or maybe you're not expending as many calories as you think you are. So
actually that last statement you said, I find, cause I do kind of as a side business, I do nutritional consultations myself, and you know, what we see many times is that it's just related to if people think they're in a calorie deficit and they're not losing weight, usually they're not in a calorie deficit or they're not in enough of a calorie deficit, because one, they're not estimating caloric intake correctly. They're not, you know, if they're doing food logs or recording their food, for instance, they're not being honest or accurate. And it may not be that they're being purposefully dishonest. They're just not being accurate because either they're misrepresenting their serving size or whatever the case may be, or sometimes they're not taking into account for little snacks that they have like here or there. Well, you know what? I just had a handful of Skittles. That's no big deal. Yeah, but you had it three or four times a day, you know. just little stuff like that, which, as you well know, can make a huge impact over the course of a day. So mm-hmm. a lot of times, you know, and then people that were gaining weight, it's like, you know, and I say that because we've been dealing with that now with some of our ball players, is that, you know, okay, tell me, you know, and these guys, you know, they have, you know, they have to eat, they have to report and eat three times a day, but then when you take a look at it, you know, they report in that they're eating dinner, but when you go over there and check it out, they're eating a bowl of cereal.
Mm.
You know, so it's little stuff like that where, you know, again, it could be what they're eating in addition to, you know, how much, but at the end of the day, it's all, you know, this, it's all about calories.
Mm-hmm.
No, are you taking in too many, or are you taking in too little? And, you know, and I'm not talking, you know, and it's not talking about just one day here and there. We're talking about consistently over the course of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, over the course of a week, on average, are you hypocaloric or not? All right. Sometimes we have days where one day you're slightly hypocaloric. The next day you may be eucaloric or slightly over. The next day you're way hypocaloric because you had, you know, somebody had a couple of, you know, long meetings during the day at work and they weren't able to eat enough. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it waxes and wanes. So over the course of the week, what's that average caloric intake that you need relative to your total daily energy expenditure? And if it falls way below, then again, it's all about the energy intake. And the same thing goes with weight gain. You know, it's like,
mm-hmm.
are you truly eating enough calories? All right. And of course, with weight gain, and you know this obviously with weight loss, or when I say fat loss versus say muscle gain, if a person is wanting to gain weight primarily through muscle and not through fat gain as well, but you know, both processes take time, but with muscle gain, obviously they can exacerbate that with resistance training, mm-hmm. rather than just sitting around and just eating excess calories. They can eat excess calories, but if they're not pushing the muscle, increase the process of protein synthesis, then any weight that they gain is primarily going to be more fat than it is muscle,
mm-hmm.
because the body's not being stimulated to increase its rate of muscle protein synthesis. So anyway, so that's my take. You know what? And I listen and I see posts, and you know, and particularly for my, and I'm going to give him a little bit of a shout out here too, for my very good friend and respected colleague, and that's Dr. Lane Norton, and he posts a lot about this. You know, mm-hmm. guys, you know, you're either eating enough or you're not. Period. You know.
Yep.
You can scream about hormones all you want, you know, and I'm, you know, my carbs and my insulin are, you know.
Yeah.
It's either too few or too many. You know, either way. At the end of the day, it's all about how many calories have you taken in. Period.
Yeah, it's one of those that it cracks me up that people like to talk about how like nutrient timing is so important for these anabolic hormones and utilizing certain nutrients within the training window and how important that is. Yeah, that's really important, but it's not more important than knowing you're getting enough calories. Like,
absolutely.
So at the end of the day, like, yeah, like I always bring it back to like the budget analogy. Like you can make a ton of money all in one time, let's say, but if it's still not enough to cover all your bills, then you're still in debt.
Absolutely.
So if you want to be able to save for a trip to Disney World, you have to know what your budget is. You have to know how much you're making. And then you have to be able to set some aside so that you can afford that adaptation.
Yeah, that's actually a very good analogy. I like that. You know, it's and then, you know, again, if you do get in a large amount of money at one time, for instance, then you alluded to this. Then how do you budget that over time to be able to make it work as long as possible? You know, mm-hmm. it's kind of like, you know, it's like, are you going to eat all your calories in one meal, all your daily calories in one meal? You're going to space them out over the course of the day. You know, there are those that would say, well, it doesn't matter. You know, and there are some studies that kind of suggest that it doesn't matter. Meal frequency really doesn't matter that much. It's at the end of the day, it's how many calories you've taken in. Well, that would probably be more fitting for people who are untrained or not training. I shouldn't say training. Who are not training, who are sedentary, Mm-hmm. But for people like, you know, for people who are training and training intensely, then they would be much better served if they had more frequent meals throughout the day that constituted their overall caloric intake, respectively. So, you know, so like you said, the nutrient timing window and all that, you know, and meal frequency, that ends up being important stuff. But you know, I was just talking to a young gentleman just a couple of weeks ago who was, you know, he was talking to me and he was giving me the song. He was hitting all the sweet notes, you know, about my, you know, nutrient timing and this, that, and the other, and the amount of protein he was taking in. But then when I started pushing him a little bit, you know, he was hitting all those notes right. But what happened is that the final note at the end of the song, meaning at the end of the day, he wasn't taking in enough calories. So I'm like, you know what? You can nutrient time all you want, but dude, you're not taking in enough calories. So I'm sorry, you're not going to be putting on any size.
Yep.
So, yeah. You know.
Yeah, you're in debt.
Exactly.
Nothing's going into savings.
You're hypocaloric, you're in debt, and you know, you're not taking enough calories, particularly if you're doing heavy resistance training, for instance. Mm-hmm. You're not taking in enough calories to do a number of things, but specifically to meet the needs for elevated muscle protein synthesis, mm-hmm. because it costs energy. You know, mm-hmm. we use ATP to make new proteins, and so if that energy is not there by way of caloric intake, then the process of muscle protein synthesis is going to be significantly hindered. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. I struggle, well, I don't necessarily struggle with this. My athletes tend to struggle with this because a lot of them are endurance athletes. And so trying to convince them to not just eat until they're full, but to know what their calorie needs are and then hit them, because it's not enough to just, like you said, fuel for the training session. Do you want to have enough fuel on the front end so that you can apply a potent training stimulus that your body can then adapt from or adapt to? There's a whole lot more involved than just, oh, well, you know, I had a decent run, or I had a decent bike ride, or I had a decent swim. Like, if you're going into that session with the gas tank half empty, then now you've got a huge hill to climb just to get to the point where you're refueled for the next training session, let alone being able to adapt to that training session.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. And then, you know, another thing I use the example with that's related to that is, you know, is what do you do in your post-exercise recovery period nutrition-wise? Because a lot of times people, whether it's endurance, resistance exercise, a lot of times, you know, they're thinking about nutrient timing or that anabolic window, you know, or the window that's where that's the most, you know, the most receptive for glycogen replenishment and that type of thing. So a lot of times they're thinking along the lines of one or maybe two meals, you know, the first hour, maybe 2 to 3 hours after training. And then they don't think beyond that. Mm-hmm. And so I tell them, I said, you know what, the time when you cease your training session on that day to the time when you start your training on the following day, mm-hmm. that's your post-exercise recovery period. Mm-hmm. Don't think about it as my pre-exercise meal, because, you know, you can think about it that way, but it's still post-exercise. And so you have to be thinking and applying strategy meticulously throughout that entire post-exercise recovery period to do exactly what you just indicated, to get your gas tank or yourself metabolically ready for the next training session so that you don't come in a deficit, particularly if you're talking about carbohydrates in an endurance individual. If you're talking—
I lost you there for a second. Can you go back maybe 2-3 thoughts? Sorry about that.
Man, you know me. I don't have no clue where that was. Let's say maybe I was just saying that, you know, the post-exercise recovery period extends from the time when you stop exercising on yes. one day until the point when you start exercising on the next day. And gotcha. So, you know, sometimes people think about post-exercise nutrition as one or two meals after their exercise session, where they should be thinking about it all the way through, even up to maybe their pre-bedtime meal or their pre-bedtime snack, and then their meal when they first arrive, and all the way up. And again, that it's going to vary based on when somebody trains. Is it early in the day, or is it middle day, or is it, you know, is it later in the day? But that being said, is that, of course, endurance athletes are primarily going to be most concerned about carbs, but they also need to also be concerned about protein intake as well, because those individuals need more protein than what they usually think they do anyway. And of course, we know that through research. You know that better than anybody else. And so with resistance training people, it's not so much about our carbohydrate level. I mean, that's important, but you know, if you're talking about an hour and a half of intense training, you know, we're going to use a relatively small amount of muscle glycogen as opposed to somebody who's doing endurance training. Mm-hmm. Our issue is more related to muscle protein synthesis if the goal is putting on muscle. Mm-hmm. Because we know from studies that, you know, one single bout of resistance exercise will elevate muscle protein synthesis for up to 12, 24 hours mm-hmm. and perhaps longer. Just that's one bout of exercise. So we know that our exercise session stimulates muscle protein synthesis. So why can't we not augment that through nutrition? Because we know that research has been very, very clear that we can augment that through nutrition, through, you know, our caloric intake, whether it's carbohydrates, whether it's protein, particularly protein, but still to be able to take advantage of that more robustly open nutrient timing window, if you will, because when it comes to protein, the term nutrient timing window, or you know, window of feeding, however one wants to look at it relative to protein, there's not one that we've been able to define. With carbs, we know that, you know, the longer you wait after, the less receptive this muscle is going to be able to resynthesize glycogen. We know that, all right? Mm-hmm. But with protein, we don't know that. So, mm-hmm. you know, we just simply know that after exercise, that providing protein will help augment muscle protein synthesis. So, we don't know whether is that taking it in right after or an hour after or 2 hours after? We don't really know. Mm-hmm. But like you, I'm sure, I mean, I just typically will recommend people, well, since we don't really know, then it would probably behoove you to just go ahead and start taking in protein as quickly as you can after your exercise bout. Mm-hmm. You know, why throw chance to the wind? Let's just go ahead and start doing it now and continue to follow that out until the next day when you hit the gym, you know, or if you hit the track or you hit the cycle or the pool or whatever the case may be. Because, you know, protein intake applies very, very similar to both the endurance athletes and resistance training athletes. There's really no difference. The only primary difference is the amount. Other than that, the process is the same, because endurance athletes have elevated levels of muscle protein synthesis. That is for sure. Endurance athletes' needs for muscle protein synthesis are to support the synthesis of proteins that are involved in aerobic oxidative related metabolism, so oxidative enzymes and so on and so forth that are involved in the muscle operating oxidatively to use oxygen more effectively and more efficiently to make ATP for energy. Mm-hmm. Right? Resistance training, that's not the case. It's proteins that are used to substantiate the muscle fibers to increase muscle force, and in addition to that, then they increase in size. You know, with endurance training, that's not necessarily the case in terms of size, because there's not the heavy force capacity that has to be dealt with. But it's more of an issue of using protein as a way to support protein synthesis for those oxidative protein related components. So, and a lot of times people don't understand that, but it's just as critical. Protein intake in endurance athletes is no less important than it is in meatheads. It's just not. So
thank you so much for saying that, because that's an idea that I have to combat relatively consistently, just because, like you said, the idea is, okay, well, if you're not trying to grow your muscle, then why would you need more protein? And like the most common answer that I provide is, are you not damaging your muscles when you train?
Like, they're doing that for sure.
Right. So whether it's from squatting, deadlifting, or running a marathon or training for a marathon, there's a lot of muscle damage going on. So you've got to have enough to repair the damaged tissue. And then it's probably not going to hurt to have a little bit extra so that you can, so that you can prevent the excessive breakdown of muscle tissue, and so that you're not tapping into stored muscle tissue as a source of fuel. This, like, the class when this topic came up absolutely blew my mind when we were talking about specifically about taking in a bolus of branched chain amino acids, you know, before an endurance bout, just so that you're kind of preventing the body from having to tap into stored muscle, you know, utilizing cortisol to break down muscle tissue, to send it to the liver, to make sugar. That blew my mind because I was like, man, nobody out here that I've ever heard of has ever said anything about, you know, maintaining the size or quality or efficiency of the engine with regards to endurance training. It's all just put gas in the tank. And so that was huge for me. I was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, that, and you're exactly right, because, you know, if you think about it, with a lot of endurance athletes, depending on what, you know, what their primary type of training is, whether there's marathon, whether it's triathlon, whatever the case may be, if it's, you know, if it's something that is of appreciable duration, and then based on their training and how much volume they're putting in during the week, the issue and the problem with that is, as you remember, because we talked about in class, is that a lot of times those individuals, it is very, very, very difficult for those individuals to get in enough calories. But the other thing is, if I can back up a bit, and that's during the training session itself, based on what their training session's like, you know, much less their actual event, if you're talking about a marathon, triathlon or whatever. But, you know, you're talking about the body not being able to meet metabolically the demands of that potentially that training session through, for instance, just carbohydrate. Well, not going to from carbohydrate, in the, depending on the duration of it. But then not so much just from fat, because then the body will also utilize protein as a fuel source. It really doesn't have much choice, because, you know, its cortisol is released during that type of, and we know that resistance exercise has a very, very minor impact on cortisol, and the cortisol is levels decrease are attenuated within about 30 minutes after the exercise session. So it has no impact on muscle atrophy, muscle protein breakdown at all. Okay. Mm-hmm. People get freaked out about that. Oh my God, you know, my cortisol levels are increased when I work out doing resistance training. Okay, big deal. It has no, it does it because it's the body's way of trying to mobilize it for potential substrate utilization, but it's not needed for that. Mm-hmm. Well, in endurance training, we know different, because, you know, it's finding a way to be able to substantiate energy demand over that longer course of training. Cortisol levels elevate, they stay elevated. We know from the literature that cortisol levels can just be significantly elevated. There's data show at the end of a triathlon, I mean, a marathon's it is way up there. Yeah. And the reason it's way up there is a stress response is to be able to mobilize substrate, and that substrate is protein. Breaks it down, as you said, and uses it as a fuel source. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if that's the case, and that's also perhaps occurring with training through the week, then what you said is totally on point. Elevate your protein intake to be able to minimize protein breakdown as much as possible. You know, I use it, and you remember this in class, I use this example all the time. Very, very, very serious, well-conditioned endurance athletes, what do they look like? Are they all muscular and jacked and stacked? No, they're not. Because remember what I said. What endurance training is what? Is it anabolic or catabolic?
It is a catabolic
scenario.
Yeah.
By and large, resistance training is an anabolic scenario. Catabolic is not. because they're using large amounts of fuel. So, and part of that is muscle being used for fuel. So you have to be able to, as you said, to be able to counteract that as best as possible. And relative to muscle protein breakdown, the best way to do that is increase protein intake on a daily basis to help minimize muscle protein breakdown. And like what you're doing with some of them, I can see, is it doing some amount of low to moderate intensity resistance training just a little bit during the week can have a huge impact on maintaining muscle mass as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's, you know, what I found is that dealing with nutrition wise, dealing with endurance athletes is way more difficult than with meatheads. Meatheads, which I'm one of them, we're pretty simple. Just give us more protein and we're good, you know? Yeah. But with endurance athletes, that's not the case. They're, I mean, those people are, I mean, you know, they can be pretty tricky based on what type and of training they're doing and volume of training. It's mm-hmm. just, it can, as you well know, it can be very tricky. So,
yeah, it's, I have to prioritize things for sure when it comes to not only my endurance athletes, but athletes in general. You know, I have to make sure first and foremost, they're eating in a way that they can adhere to long term. Then, you know, they're hitting their calorie goal. And if they miss it within a 24-hour window, then we just zoom out and we make it a 72-hour window or a week window, just so that, you know, like it doesn't have to be perfect every single 24-hour day. Like there's flexibility here. And then from there, in general, I try to work them up to 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight.
Yep.
Regardless of the activity that they're training for, whether it's, you know, a high school basketball player or a track athlete or, you know, somebody who's training for an Ironman, if they can tolerate more and they want more and they understand the value, then shoot, it's not gonna hurt to go over.
Nope.
So could you just jump in a little bit right here and talk about, like, is that an appropriate amount of protein? What's the research say currently about, you know, what amount is optimal? What amount is effective? What amount is optimal, I guess?
Actually, that's a good question. And that right now is you know, it's a bit of a source of controversy right now, but in my mind, particularly, you know, you read on social media, it's a significant source of humor, because I read some of this stuff and I'm like, seriously? So, you know, but so to answer your question, is 1 gram per pound, that's, for most people, that's plenty. You know, that's a good amount of protein.
Okay.
The other thing is, I wanted to kind of interject here, is that a lot of times people, and this is probably more so with like in physique competition, for instance, like bodybuilders and, you know, classic standard figure, you know, and it's just something that's kind of transformed over time. But I know it can extend into other avenues as well around in sports. And so, you know, not that bodybuilding is a sport and not that we're athletes per se, because there's a lot of controversy there as well. But nevertheless, you know, you know, I'm not addressing that to try to start up a controversy, but you get my drift. But the issue here is that a lot of times people think throughout the course of the day, based on my meal frequency, how many times I'm eating a day, sometimes, and I deal with this a lot, people think, you know, particularly in physique competition, because I do a lot of physique prepping, coaching, is that they come to me and they think they have to eat the same amount of protein at every meal. Okay. Mm. I got it, whatever that is. And of course now, and I'll get into here in a minute about, you know, how much protein the body can use at one time and all that type of stuff. Anyway, they think, okay, I got to have every meal, I got to have the same amount of protein. And let's say 30 grams. Okay. Got to have 30 grams or, you know, or at least 30 grams to be able to round out whatever it is I need over the course of the day. Well, you know what? That's not true. You know, I'm not saying that if you don't do that, that it's not a bad thing. That's fine. But so, you know, if you have a meal here and there where you're off, you're under or you're over, it's not a big deal. You know, what matters is at the end of the day, have you taken in an adequate amount of protein? It doesn't matter, did you take in X amount of adequate amount of protein at meal 1, 2, 3, 4, because the body doesn't use it that quickly to make proteins. It's not like it uses the protein and amino acids from the protein in the meal in 1 hour, an hour and a half. It's already been using it to make all these new proteins. No, it doesn't happen that quickly. So, you know, if somebody hits their protein target with meal 1 and then they miss it with meal 2 and then they miss it with meal 3, but then they hit it at meal 4 and then at meal 5, then they go over and above, so that over the course of the day they've still hit their protein target for the day. That's all that matters. It's not about eating the same amount of protein, and there's some really, really nice studies that suggests that to be the case. It's about daily protein intake rather than how much are you taking in at each meal.
Gotcha.
And then based on, you know, the big thing right now is you know, how much protein should somebody be taking in at a time relative to how much protein the body can utilize at one time. The answer to that is we don't know. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, there's a study that was done, a very nice study a few years ago that suggested that, you know, 20 grams of protein was just as good as 40 grams of protein at stimulating muscle protein synthesis after one bout of resistance exercise in untrained men. All right. So after that, it was like, OK, so it's 20 grams, you know, you don't need 40 grams or, you know, so that range of in there, 20 to 40 grams, you know. And then from the same laboratory, they came out and replicated the study. Although the first study they used albumin and the second study whey, but protein quality is the same, so it don't matter. And then they used resistance trained individuals. And in this particular case, they found that 40 grams was more effective than 20 grams. And so now all of a sudden, the push is, okay, well, every meal we need to get in 40 grams of protein, at least 40 grams of protein. But, you know, and now, you know, and I've even seen at conferences, and I even politely called a guy out at a conference that was giving a talk on this, saying that 40 grams was the protein ceiling. Kept going upon, that's the protein ceiling, that's the protein ceiling, meaning that's the most that, you know, and I finally stood up at the end, I'm like, how do you know that? What if this study would have used 50 grams, 60 grams, 70 grams.
Yeah.
We don't know. There's not really been any studies similar enough in this regard to suggest that. So all we're going on is based on a study that showed 40. But what if that study would have shown 50 to be better or 60 to be better? So we don't know the answer to that, you know?
Yeah.
But we do know that, you know, a lot of times the thought is the more protein you eat, the better off it is relative to being able to exacerbate increases in muscle protein synthesis. That's kind of the line of thinking, particularly with meatheads. It's like, eat as much protein as you can, and you know, and it's going to make you help make you even bigger. That's not true. All right, it's not true, because you know, Philip Atherton came up with several years ago with some very elaborate research studies that he did, where with, you know, amino acid intake, particularly with leucine, but amino acid intake, and he found something and substantiated a term called the muscle full, F-U-L-L, full effect.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed that giving amino acids, and we'll just say leucine, for instance, if you increase the dose of amino acids, then let's say leucine, then you increase muscle protein synthesis, but only up to a certain amount. And then the muscle becomes fully saturated, and then and protein synthesis doesn't continue to elevate, even though you continue to increase the dose of leucine. The muscle is full. It's saturated, and it can't synthesize any more protein over and above that particular level. And so that's called the muscle full effect. Interestingly enough, is we don't really know what level that is, particularly as it translates into amino acid concentrations in muscle. You know, translating protein load that we take in versus is those digestion and those amino acids are liberated in plasma and then taken up into muscle. We don't we don't know. We haven't been able to translate that, and we don't really know what the appropriate amino acid dose is as well if somebody is giving themselves, just say, BCAAs, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's, I would suspect that it's, there's probably a difference between varying individuals. Like in the two studies that came out of, you know, my colleague Stu Phillips's lab, which is outstanding studies, you know, based on that information, it gives us a template to understand how, you know, how protein dosing can impact protein synthesis. But at the same time, you know, we don't, and how it can vary based on whether somebody is untrained or trained. His first study showed untrained 20 to 40 grams of protein elicited the same effect. Mm-hmm. Then when he somewhat replicated the study, he showed that in trained individuals, 40 grams was more. So there's something likely going on with the training, you know, with the training process that is requiring the body to have more protein to induce a greater amount of muscle protein synthesis. But again, the point at which we know that where the muscle full effect occurs, we don't know. But I would say that, you know, 1 gram per pound is a good amount of protein to give. But in all likelihood, in most individuals, it's not going to be enough to induce a muscle full effect. If you were getting like 2.5 to 3 times that amount, then yeah. I mean, really nobody needs that much protein.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, but that's a hell of a lot of protein. And, you know, Chan,
it's not palatable for most people. They just can't eat that much.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, you know, my dear friend and colleague, you know, Dr. Jose Antonio did a couple of cool studies.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
It's funny because about a year and a half before Steve did the study, he and I were always going back and forth about this concept. You know, I finally said, dude, just do a study. Well, he did a study. And so, you know, where he was given 4.5 grams per kg of protein. Now, I think that was something like 1,200 calories of protein over and above what they were already taking in. And so it had no, and they were resistance trained, it had no effect.
No negative health outcomes, right?
Do what?
No negative health outcomes either, which was pretty amazing.
Had no impact on body composition either, which, you know, which is the issue that you remember that, you know, when I would talk about in exercise biochem about, you know, eating large amounts of protein is not really going to have any significant impact on increasing adiposity or body fat levels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hormonal milieu just doesn't add up for that, you know. So it just for somebody to say it does, it's counterintuitive because biochemically the hormonal process, again, it doesn't coincide for that to even be a realistic possibility. But he showed, again, no impact on anabolism over and above the control diet, which I think was 1.8 grams per kg,
mm-hmm.
Which is very close to your 1 gram per pound.
Right.
And you know, and then he followed that up, you know, with another one that he did, I think 3.5 grams per kg, and he showed the exact same impact. So, again, that's a perfect example of the muscle full effect. You're taking in tons of protein, but nothing over and above a kind of a control diet, which is still a higher protein diet.
Right.
It had no preferential effect. And why? The muscle full effect. Saturating muscle with amino acids that the body can't use to make new protein.
So at that point,
pure and simple.
At that point, when you've reached this muscle full effect, and there's no more anabolic benefit, is there at least additional anti-catabolic benefit?
I guess potentially that being the case, but you know, if somebody's got higher amounts of protein, amino acids in their blood, then they need, they're at this muscle full effect, and so they're not clearing any more amino acids per se, or they've got all these amino acids in muscle that are not being utilized, then those amino acids will likely find themselves just being released, you know, back into circulation where they're going to be taken up into the liver and just simply degraded. They're not going to be used by gluconeogenesis to make glucose, you know, for fuel, mm-hmm. like we would in a hypocaloric state, or say during endurance exercise, because the hormones aren't there for that to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, gluconeogenesis glucagon turns on and gluconeogenesis, mm-hmm. you know, and so that being said, cortisol breaks down muscle protein to liberate amino acids into the blood, which are taken up by the liver, and then glucagon, which is, you know, obviously elevated in response to low carbohydrate, is going to be taking up, is going to be instigating gluconeogenesis to make sugar. Well, remember, what do a good amount of the essential amino acids do to insulin?
They increase insulin.
So yeah. How can you have increased glucagon when you've got a high protein load, particularly if somebody's eating carbohydrates on top of it?
Yeah.
So that's again, how, if that's the case, then mm-hmm. how can somebody get fat by eating too much protein? Because the only way that can occur is if gluconeogenesis were being upregulated to a significant extent and using all those extra amino acids to make a lot of glucose mm-hmm. that the body is not really needing at a time. So it's being cleared by the adipose tissue and being committed to de novo lipogenesis to make fatty acid and triglyceride. So you following me?
Yeah.
It's totally counterintuitive. It makes no sense to suggest, you know, unless somebody was just eating tons of excess protein, which
yeah.
people are not going to eat that much protein. So,
yeah, it
don't hold water. I'm sorry. It just don't
yeah.
hold water. You know,
I think this I'd
love Lane to be on here with me because he would be in a much more colorful way saying the exact same thing.
This right here, I think, is the crux of the whole calories don't matter argument, because anytime it's brought up, it's always this comparison. Well, if you eat 1,000 extra calories of protein versus 1,000 extra calories of carbs or fat, look what happens. Like, you don't gain any weight on this extra protein. It's like, well, but the thermic effect of protein comes into
yes.
play. And then exactly what you just said. Like, I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to that to make sure I understand completely what you're saying. Like, I understand the overarching idea where, like you said, the hormonal milieu just, it essentially kind of cancels each other out, sort of, like, where nothing's being stored. And even though there's this potential substrate.
Well, and actually, you brought up a good point that I wanted to kind of just piggyback on, and that is that, you know, if you eat excess protein to the point where the body's just having to break it down and metabolize it,
mm-hmm.
and you know, of course, it metabolizes, the liver breaks, you know, you go through transamination, deamination, the liver, you make urea that's kicked out into the blood, picked up by the kidneys, and then you just pee that out, you know, mm-hmm. and you're, because you have all this urea that you got to release in the kidney. So you've got, you know, but you've got the process of breaking down and ridding your body of excess protein that way. All right. Mm. But as you mentioned earlier, that's an energy requiring process.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you said kind of the thermic effect of excess protein intake. You know, you've kind of heard the term, when people eat, you know, like at the holidays, you sit around and eat all this turkey and you have the term the meat sweats.
Mm-hmm.
I get that every time I go to Texas Day Brazil with folks with a child in these Brazilian steakhouses, because I'm all carnival and I will just, you know, and after I'm just like, literally, I'm just like, whoa, you know,
core body temps up.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've eaten way too much protein. And so my body is metabolizing that to get rid of it, and it takes energy to do that. So you get this thermic effect from excess protein intake. Not that it's going to my adipose, but it's going out. It's, you know, liver's breaking it down, kidneys are releasing it. Of course, then you get the whole controversy. Well, you know, eating too much protein is bad on your liver and bad on your kidneys. There's really no.
Where's the data on that?
The data is not there. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, if you're talking about somebody who's like an end-stage renal disease, a kidney patient, okay, I get it, you know. But if you're talking about somebody that's got you know, healthy liver, healthy kidneys, I mean, no, you know, it's like you said, where's the data? The data's not there. Mm-hmm. At least in a non-clinical setting, the data is just not there. So, you know.
Yeah, if there's a pre-existing liver or kidney issue, then maybe.
Then, you know, an extra protein load might put a bit more metabolic stress on those two organs. Uh-huh. So that it could provide a potentially detrimental impact. But, you know, in your healthy people that you're training with, you know, healthy organ function, it's not going to make a difference, you know, or it certainly shouldn't make a difference. So, but, you know, then again, you come to the point where people, you know, most people, they shouldn't be eating that much protein anyway, you know, so you're 1.5 grams per pound. That should be enough for just about anybody, mm-hmm. whether you're endurance trained individuals or you meatheads. It should still be about good enough for just about anybody.
Gotcha. So, perfect.
And that's a good amount of protein. If you think about 1 gram per pound, okay, you know, you're talking about somebody who weighs 250 pounds, that's 250 grams of protein. That's a lot of protein, brother. That's a lot of protein, you know? So, so that's a lot of chicken breasts. To the point where I don't know about you, but I get tired, and I'm all carnivore, but I get tired of eating that much chicken throughout the day or whatever my protein source is. So, mm-hmm. you know, now if I go to, it's like I said, if I go to one of these Brazilian steakhouses, I'll eat all that in one meal. I'll fast all day long if I know that I'm going, because like I said, it's all about protein intake over the course of the day. I'll fast all day long so that I can just eat as much as possible.
That's every year on my birthday, which it's 15 days away. Well, every year on my birthday, I go to Texas Day Brazil.
That's and my favorite.
I don't eat breakfast. I don't eat lunch. And I just get my protein for sure.
So I'll go in. I'll make myself just a little bit of salad just to tell myself that I've had some veggies, which for me, all that is garnish. It's kind of like parsley on a plate. It's just garnish on a plate, you know. And then I'll set it aside, and then, you know, then I turn the thing over to green, and it's like, bring it on.
It's go time. Yeah, I probably have like three or four bowls of their lobster bisque. Like, I cannot get enough of that. But everything else is just straight.
Yeah, my wife Vicky, that's probably one of our favorite restaurants. She goes bananas for their lobster bisque, and she loves her salad bar. But you know, she's all carnivore by like me. But she's like you. She'll eat at least two bowls of the lobster bisque, and you know, and so, and then the salad bar. She's got all the salmon and the, you know, the stuff on there as well. And so, you know, but I want the chicken stuff's good, but I want I want the filet. You know, I want the red meat. I want the now you got me. Yeah, now you got me really hungry.
That reminds me of another topic that I would love to quickly discuss if you have the time.
Sure.
And that is red meat really bad for you? Do we need to avoid it? Because
no.
Why not?
I mean, you know, it's, you know, I mean, you're talking about, you know, red meat is a bit higher in saturated fat than some of your other, you know, your protein sources. But if you're getting, you know, again, if you're getting a leaner cut of red meat and you need to be somewhat concerned about saturated fat, then so be it. Red meat is chock full of B vitamins, which are good, which some of the other, which the poultry meats are not. Mm-hmm. So, but you know what, again, you can talk about red meat from a variety of sources. And some people say, well, you know, it's higher in fat and higher in calories. Well, so be it. At the end of the day, it's all about calories anyway.
Right.
Just account for it. I mean, what's the big deal, you know? Yeah.
So get more fat, then you just don't eat as much fat at another meal. You just adjust. I was actually having this conversation yesterday with a kid in medical school who wanted to discuss this, and he was saying like he doesn't eat any red meat because all the research indicates that red meat causes cardiovascular disease and increased risk of cancer. And yeah, and I'm just like, what do those studies actually say? And they're all dietary recall studies, and the way that they're determining a what do they call it, a serving of red meat, like the range on what they consider red meat is just, it's pretty ridiculous. Like a slice of pizza with two pieces of pepperoni on it from like the gas station, that's considered red meat. And then like, you know, a 4 ounce grass-fed filet, that's also a serving of red meat, and we're gonna say that that's the same thing. Like, there's obvious weaknesses with this study. So
you're not comparing an apple to an apple by any stretch, you know. So yeah, so you're exactly on point. Yeah, you can't. I mean, you know, and that's based on, primarily that's based on saturated fat intake, which we obviously know has a link to cardiovascular disease, but it's saturated fat. You know, what about fried chicken? You know, if you're particularly, you know, if you're talking about fried chicken now that's used, you know, that's deep fried with, you know, with vegetable oil, well, then that's a little bit of a difference. But, you know, I grew up in a time, because I'm old enough, I grew up in a time almost everything that we ate was deep fried was from lard. I mean, so saturated fat, you know, whether it was fried chicken, whether it was bacon, whatever. I mean, you know, my grandmother had a lard jar right on the side of her of the stove, and she would just, you know, at room temp, it was just solid, and she would dig a big spoon and throw it in the iron skillet, you know, and that's why over time everything that we had tasted like fried chicken, whether it was eggs or whatever, because when she got done and the lard was obviously liquid form, she'd pour it right back in the lard jar.
Nice. You know?
Of course, I mean that's some good old fashioned southern cooking right there. Okay. That's what I grew up on. But you know, so, but again, to get back on point, I mean, you know, it's saturated fat. Yes, there's kind of this somewhat documented link to increasing the risk in for cardiovascular disease and certain type of cancers. But you know, it's primarily based on that and its ability for atherogenesis or plaque formation. It's not the red meat itself. It's just the fact that red meat contains that. So, you know, but then you're talking about eating, you know, leaner cuts that have, you know, less amount of saturated fat, then, you know, then so be it, you know. Like you said, you just moderate, because you can, if somebody can, they can eat other foods in throughout the day that aren't red meat related and take in way more saturated fat than they might get from a 6 ounce sirloin steak. I mean, yeah, it's just, yeah, it's, that stuff is, yeah, that stuff is kind of funny. Yeah.
Are those
different things that you hear?
Yeah. Are those studies also taking into account calorie need and whether these people are in a calorie surplus and whether they're active?
No.
Like, there's all these other things that are probably way more significant.
Well, and the other thing is, and that's another good point, Kevin, is that some of these studies they do are more epidemiologic types of studies. Yeah. It's like kind of like correlational studies. Okay, so how much red meat do you typically eat in every day or over the course of a week? And they get that type of information, and then they put all that in. It's like, okay, well, you know, these people, they ate more red meat in their diet, And as a result, the incidence rate of cardiovascular disease or cancer was higher. So immediately it has to be the red meat. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and you're right. They don't take into account exercise and all that different types of stuff. Because, you know, as well as I do, cardiovascular endurance-oriented exercise, the benefits it has on HDL profiles, and that can actually combat that process. So that might mean the person can get away with eating more red meat because their type of exercise they're doing makes them more conducive to perhaps counteracting that atherogenic effect based on their HDL to LDL ratio. It's kind of smoke and mirrors,
right,
with some of those studies, you know, and it's how people interpret some of those studies, you know, or how those studies are interpreted and then presented in mass media. That's a big problem that I found it also. So
kind of related to that, specifically about fat and saturated fat, is this idea that a low-fat diet is ideal, right? So for the longest time, like when the good old-fashioned food guide pyramid was, you know, that was like the staple. That's what everyone was supposed to follow. You know, super low-fat diet, less than, you know, 10 to 15% of your total calories coming from fat, and as little as possible coming from saturated fat sources. How does that affect your hormones, specifically your sex hormones, and then your ability to then repair and adapt?
So, you know, well, first of all, real quick, we know is that, you know, we found out that the, you know, back, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, you know, with weight loss, that was a big push, you know, low fat, fat-free, low fat diets. Well, so they're recommended low fat in the diet, but they weren't even touching carbs. So you can eat, you know, you can eat lots of carbs, just make sure that you have, you know, you have a low fat diet, you know, and, but what we started seeing is that people kept getting fatter and fatter. Mm-hmm. So now we begin to realize it's not fat. It's excess intake of carbohydrate. That's what's primarily making people fat, you know, or fatter.
Over their calorie needs, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, yes, they're overeating calories primarily via carbohydrate calories. So, you know, so we see that, you know, we see that being the case, but then, and then related to what you're talking about testosterone, I mean, we know that, you know, saturated fat intake, for instance, relative to some of the hormones, you know, it's hard to pinpoint. Is it actually saturated fat, for instance, or is it perhaps maybe the consequence of high saturated fat intakes that might impact testosterone? And this is where I'm going with this. So we know, for instance, in men that overweightness or obesity causes a decrease, causes hypogonadism. So it decreases testosterone levels. So, you know, but what is it that's causing the obesity? Is it inactivity? Is it overeating? Overeating and activity? Is it primarily overeating coming from high amounts of saturated fat or whatever the case may be? It's hard to pinpoint whether it's high intake of saturated fat versus anything else. But, you know, you have to instead look at the potential outcome of high intake of saturated fat or just high calories that contributes to overweightness in men that drives testosterone because it blunts the testosterone axis. So, you know, I guess I'm not dodging the question, but that question's a little bit hard to answer if you're looking at it to a specific macronutrient, you know, because again, I think it's more related to the outcome more so than the individual macronutrient itself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. So, yeah. Related to that, is there a range of, not necessarily saturated fat, but just fat in general in your diet that's going to produce, good or optimal outcomes with regards to the production and efficacy of your sex hormones?
Well, we know, I mean, obviously, you know, testosterone, your sex hormones, I mean, they're, you know, they have a cholesterol moiety associated with them. So they're lipid based hormones. And so, you know, we know that being said is that, you know, as they're synthesized endogenously, the synthesis of them, let's say whether it's testosterone, estradiol, which is the primary estrogenic hormone, they start with cholesterol. And so, you know, and so from that, then, you know, a high fat diet, you know, if that fat is able to be broken down and the cholesterol used from that, then, you know, it could play a role in maybe perhaps. But that's where you get, perhaps there's an optimum level of fat intake that might impact cholesterol levels to be able to help boost or optimize testosterone production. What that level might be, I'm not aware. But again, then you get to the point where, you know, high amounts of fat intake, if it ends up triggering overweightness, obesity, then it's actually going to blunt the axis. So again, you know, based on the fact that, you know, that the fat, saturated fat, fat in general, the cholesterol used from these guys can be used to you know, to promote cholesterol. So if you think about it from the standpoint of if the testosterone axis is blunted, or, well, let me back up. So, you know, you've got, if you're creating too much testosterone than the body is using, then of course it aromatizes to estrogen. So you can look at it from that regard. Or if the testosterone axis is blunted, then it could be blunted in a way that it affects the testosterone estradiol ratio. So somebody in a male, for instance, becomes more estrogen dominant, which wouldn't really be a real good thing. And so, you know, but the same, that same issue outcome could come with females, but now we're looking more relative to estradiol, not so much with testosterone. So, you know, because they're more, they're physiologically, they're more estrogen dominant than we are. We're more testosterone dominant than them, but we know that, that they, you know, their endogenous synthesis pathways are somewhat interrelated as well, particularly in the adrenal gland. So, you know, where testosterone in, you know, in females, the majority of it is synthesized, comes in the adrenal gland, where in the males, it comes from obviously in the testes. So, but still, you know, those pathways are, as I said, are interrelated. So anyway, so on that one, that's, you know, not knowing that literature any more than I do, that's probably the best I could give you without without sticking my head into the literature and just seeing what's out there and what's kind of recent. So.
Gotcha. So the reason I ask, I'm just I'd like you to kind of critique the way that I generally program fat calories for some of my clients. So after I, you know, kind of assess what I or predict their caloric need, their maintenance level of calories, and then, you know, 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, I found quite a bit of data showing that if you go less than 20% of your total calories from fat, that can have a negative effect on testosterone production. So I've seen a lot of people say, you know, 25 to 30% of maintenance level calories is usually pretty good. So that's typically where I go, right around there. So do you think that's pretty safe?
Yeah, I would say so. And it all comes back to what I was talking about earlier, is that, you know, is if you cut fat dramatically, then, you know, then you can potentially have an impact on the amount of cholesterol that the body is receiving nutritionally to be able to use to synthesize testosterone or other sex hormones endogenously. You know, and so you know, even though the body makes its own cholesterol in the liver through the HMG-CoA reductase pathway, you know, still we can, you know, we can provide cholesterol from our diet that can also be of assistance with hormone, you know, lipid hormone production. You know, it's not just sex hormones, but cortisol and other lipid-based hormones as well. But in this particular case, particularly the sex hormones as well. So, you know, so, you know, I would go along with that. I mean, I think that, and on the grand scheme of things, I mean, we need fat in our diet. So trying to go zero fat, whether it's, you know, saturated or unsaturated, of course we want more unsaturated than saturated, but we need fat in our diet. Fat is good. Our body needs it, you know. Unfortunately, whether it's, you know, the same thing with carbohydrate, but unfortunately in our society, we don't moderate very well. Particularly when it comes to nutrition and diet, we just don't moderate very well. And so, you know, it's, you know, you can't stop with just maybe two pieces of pizza. You got to have six or eight, you know?
Yeah. Moderation isn't sexy.
No, not well, well,
it's hard to sell moderation.
It certainly is. What's that old saying? What you eat behind closed doors, you wear in public.
Wow.
So, you know, so if that, in that, if that regard, then I don't know, you know, it, that might be sexy. I don't know. Wearing a wearing excess pizza. I don't know. So, yeah, I'll just leave that out there, you know? So, but anyway, like I said, I mean, you know, we need fat in our diet. So some amount of fat is good and also critical. So, I would say that 20% based on your macro count, I mean, that should be fine. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a good amount for anyone. So,
yeah. And especially as my clients tend to be in a calorie deficit, I figure having a little extra fat can't hurt.
No, because you know, it's easier to make up calories with fat than it is with protein or carbs.
Mm-hmm. You know,
so for sure. And also based on the fact that in some cases foods that are a bit more fat concentrated, then you know, you can do it even more so with less amount of food as well, that with a higher fat content. So
yeah,
so your client may not necessarily like it because you know they don't want just a small amount, they want a more robust amount, but you know, what are you gonna do?
Can't make everybody happy all the time.
No. In the end, they're going to do what they want to do anyway. So you set them out on this diet here, and then they come back, and you know, it's funny sometimes with my prep, you know, for physique competitions. That, you know, my athletes or my competitors. Again, I'm not sure whether they're athletes or not, but you know, some people would agree or disagree. But I'll just say my clients. You know, they'll say, well, you know, I'm tracking their progress and it's just not, you know, happening. And I'm like, you know, and I know they're cheating on their diet, you know. I know I don't look like the sharpest knife in the drawer, but, you know, I'm not that dull. And so, you know, I'm like, okay, you know, I know what you're on works. I mean, it's scientifically sound. It works and it will work if you're not cheating on your diet, you know. So, yeah, that's when I was kind of alluding to the fact that, you know, you can set them all up and have them on a great plan. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about them. You know, are they going to stick to it? You know, again, the old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink.
Right.
You know, you can set them up on course, but they have to do it themselves. You can't do it for them. I can't do it for them. And I tell them that you're right. You got to own it, you know? And so, so yeah, anyway.
Gotcha. Well, this has been so amazing, Doc. Thank you so much. I wanted to give you a little time just to plug your new gym in Waco. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh yeah, sure. So we've got you know, of course my day job is you know, I'm a professor of exercise and nutritional biochemistry at Baylor University, and I've been there for 15 years, and so that's my day job. And then on the side, I'm a co-owner of Peak to Perform, which is a sport nutrition and a supplement store. So, you know, I always kind of had two gyms. Being a meathead, I said I'd be cool to own my own supplement store and my own gym, and so I do that now. So I don't own them outright. I'm a co-owner. So so I co-own Peak to Perform here in Waco, and then I also own Josh Barrett. He's a Baylor alumni, and he's also a competitive bodybuilder as well, and just a super, super good dude. And so I co-own it with and it's something we've been working towards for quite a long time, he and I and my wife Vicky. And so, but anyway, it's a personal training gym, and it's called Lab.
It's fitting.
Yeah, the Lab, Fitness and Wellness Services, but just the Lab. And so, you know, we like that name because we use it as a way. Of course, you know, Josh kind of, he's the one that brought it up. He goes, let's name it the Lab. He goes, you know, you're a scientist and, you know, you work in the lab, but he said also we can use this as a lab and a way of transforming people's lives. And so I said, you know what, I like that, you know. So anyway, so it's called the Lab. It's here in Waco, and we've been open for now for about softly open for about 3 weeks, but we have our grand opening on Saturday.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, and so we're, you know, that's kind of like our coming out, if you will, even though we've already got, I don't know, we've got four or five trainers that are contracted with us, and, you know, and we have two massage therapists that are contracted with us, and we have a guy who's contracted with us who does body composition house. He owns a bod pod. And so, you know, and then Josh and Vicky, they, you know, they're personal trainers, and they have their own clients that they train there as well. And so, yeah, so, you know, Josh and my wife, Vicky, they pretty much run it. You know, I have a day job that keeps me very, very, very busy. So, you know, but we've been busy the last, up to this point, just getting everything up and going, getting it all buttoned up, and just in terms of all the things that we want to have ready for the grand opening. And so we'll be, we've got that. So I'm teaching summer school right now. So, you know, I finished and then I went today and then I got a quick workout and then I did a little bit of work there and then I came home so that we could do the podcast with you. And so tomorrow the same, when I get teaching, then I'll run over, work out. Then again, I got three little things that I want to do before Saturday. So, you know, and, yeah. So after Saturday, then hopefully the chaos will begin to dissipate a bit. But, you know, it's yeah, it's been fun, and it's been one of those things that we've been praying for a long time, particularly Vicky and I, and also Josh, and, you know, as a way to kind of use it as a ministry to be able to impact people's lives in a positive way, both through their emotional health and their physical health, because those are oftentimes tied. You know, a lot of times people struggle emotionally. Their emotional health, you know, they struggle because it's linked to their physical health. They're overweight, they're inactive, they're overweight maybe, and because of that, they don't feel good, you know, it's messed up here, or they don't like the way they look, you know, it affects their emotional health. So, you know, we can use that a way to improve their physical health, and then from that, then hopefully that translates into them feeling better about themselves, and as a result, it has an overall positive impact on their quality of life. You know, and so, and like I said, you know, in our ministry way, you know, if they, people have a better view of themselves, then hopefully they can understand that then at that point that, and maybe open them up so that they can be more in tune with their faith. And so, you know, we just using it in that way is, again, as a vessel to be able to just help improve the lives of others. So, you know, we're not out to get rich. We're out, you know, we're out to just help others, in a very, very positive way. So, that's what it's all about. So yeah, the name of it's called The Lab, and, check us out online at thelabfitness.co. And, we're also on Facebook. We're on Instagram at thelabfitness.waco. So you can kind of check us out and follow us and just give us support. And, you know, that'll help. That'll help us moving along. And so, we appreciate, any support. And same thing with, you know, with Peak to Perform. I mean, it's, you know, I enjoy it because, you know, the supplements in the store are only ones I endorse. You know, as you well know, part of my expertise is nutrition supplements. And, you know, I've consulted with, pretty much all of the major supplement companies out there and help formulate products, reformulate products. And so, again, if you're not going to see a product on our shelves that I don't endorse and I don't work with my other co-owners to say, you know, this, not this, and, you know, so I provide, you know, my other co-owners, they, you know, it's kind of interesting because they're in the fitness, because they both co-own Train Waco, which used to be CrossFit Waco, and so I got involved with them because they called me in a few years ago to help come in and start doing some of the nutrition work for some of their CrossFitters, particularly the serious ones that were trying to work towards the games, and so. And so that was fun. And one of the co-owners, Brandon, I've known for a long time because he and I used to work out in the same gym together. And so that relationship just kind of blossomed. And then we started talking about the store, and it's like, well, you know, let's do it. I said, you know, each of us has their kind of their, you know, Jonathan kind of has his niche in the store, and Brandon has his niche in the store, and then my niche primarily is just from giving the scientific substantiation to the store by virtue of all the products that we carry and being able to stand behind those and give information about the products and so on and so forth. So it's been fun. You know, it's nice. I'm at a point in my academic career. It's kind of nice to have the challenges and other diversions, if you will, so they can kind of get me out of the biochemistry lab, so you know, so that I'm not as much like a lab rat as I once was, you know.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
So you know, I still train every day and I still compete in bodybuilding, and my competition's been a bit sidelined because I had my knee totally replaced, so I'm having to work and rehab and try to now just try to put size back on it. So much I lost during that rehab process, but you know, I'm still grinding every day, you know, and trying to get as nasty as I can, you know, and moving heavy weight around. So, you know, things haven't changed any from when you were there, you know, as my grad student. Things haven't changed much. It's just kind of another day, another day that we just continue to do what we do. So
it blows my mind. I started in the fall of 2009. So that's 10 years ago this year. Like that, it feels like I was just there. Like,
yeah, well, you know what? I was talking to somebody just the other day. It just, you know, I've been here 15 years and it's just, I've worked with so many of you guys, masters and doctoral students. Of course, I primarily teach and deal with grad students, very few undergrads, and then run the lab. But with the exception of the first two classes, particularly the first two classes of doctoral students, in terms of being able to know what years they graduated, like now, if before you told me that, if you would have asked me, said, do you remember what year I graduated? I would say no. Because, and it's nothing against you, but you got, it's just time, just, it's just, it just all runs together.
Yeah.
And I've had so many of you guys, and you guys have been so also wonderful and awesome, but yet it's hard for me to, you know, it's hard for me to know. I could have given you a general idea and I might've gotten it right, but I probably would have come within about 2 or 3 years of being right if I got it wrong. But again, it's just, you know, there's been so many of you guys, it's just hard. I mean, I remember each and every one of you. I'll never forget that, you know, but it's awesome because like with you and so many others, you guys continue to stay in touch and you reach out and, you know, it's, I really, really, really appreciate that. And what you said earlier about, you know, being, you know, your kind words about, you know, about, how I've helped you, you know, professionally. You know, it means a lot. It's nice to know that, you know, that the time that I put in, and I've tried to do it as much as I can selflessly, you know, is appreciated, you know, and not only appreciated, but it's being helpful in helping to impact, you know, the lives of my students. That's what it's all about. You know, I didn't get into academia because I wanted to get rich, because anybody knows that if you're in academics, you're not going to get rich. You know, that has... But not financially, not monetarily. I've gotten rich from being able to interact and be blessed by students like yourself that, you know, that that just continue to motivate me to get up and go into work each day and knowing that, you know, I might be able to impact somebody in a positive way. That's what it's all about, you know?
Yeah. No, I seriously appreciate it. I don't consider myself done learning, and so I, like, even though I'm not in the classroom with you, like when you post something about a study that you guys just published, I'm like, all right, sweet, here's my chance to, you know, I'm back in the classroom again, like I'm gonna go read it. So I appreciate being able to continue to learn from you, and especially appreciate you, you know, coming on and answering all my questions. And
well, that makes two of us, and I don't mean to interrupt you. That makes two of us, because I mean, I'm not done learning either. I mean, there's so much out there to learn, you know. And when I quit learning as an academic, then I'm dead, you know, because that's when you fail to be able to provide your students with the most updated information in our field, and they deserve that, you know. And there's so many academics that they're, you know, they're still just, you know, they're still teaching stuff that they taught they were teaching 10 and 15 years ago. And in the sciences, like our field, you can't do that because it's so dynamic. It's like a snowball rolling downhill. It just continues to pick up momentum with the new things that we learn, even in nutrition and exercise, sport nutrition. It's baffling, the new stuff that we've learned compared to like 5 years ago when you were in school. You know, it's like, okay, well, and you got to stay up on that. You got to stay up on that because you're using that for your clients. Even though you're not in a classroom anymore, it just still doesn't matter. You're still an academic, and you still will always be an academic because you've got to continue to learn and educate yourself, you know? So that's just part of it, you know? So, I'll always be happy and honored to come on your show. So any other times, just let me know. So, you know,
I'll definitely need you back on in the future to catch me up on all the latest and greatest things. So,
anybody that's listening, that's interested, you know, they can find me on, you know, on Instagram, on Facebook. They just type my name in on Facebook and there I am. And on Instagram, I'm in, you know, as Dr. Darren and Vicky, because my wife Vicky and I share that account. Mm-hmm. You know, so much of what we do professionally, we, you know, out in this realm of training, we do together. And so, so we share that account, but then I don't do Twitter or any of the other stuff. But then obviously people can reach out to me if they want and just send me an email through my Baylor account. Darren_Willoughby@Baylor.edu. You know, I'm happy to entertain any questions. And you know, again, we're all in this together. So, you know.
For sure. Awesome. Thank you again so much. And everybody who's watching and listening, go follow Dr. Willoughby right now. Don't waste any time. So, alrighty, we will definitely have you on again in the future. And thank you so much again. Have a good evening, sir.
All right. You do the same, my friend. Take care.
Alrighty, y'all. Stay tuned for the next episode.